This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Weather is not climate, but the recent heat wave in the Pacific Northwest was so extreme, climate scientists are trying to help us answer, did climate change fuel the heat?
If we don't give an answer that's based on scientific methods, then some kind of answer is going to be obtained.
Also today, thousands of Liberians were given a path to citizenship here in the U.S. Problem is, the path is paved with red tape.
So I printed bank records, school transcripts, and employment authorization cards. My entire immigration history, yes.
And the history of two Jewish families from Baghdad who helped shape modern Shanghai.
The Kadouris and the Sassoons really made Shanghai a place that everyone had to visit.
Grand hotels built on the proceeds from the opium trade. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It's good to have you with us on a Friday. The Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan, it's been one of the most visible symbols of the U.S. military presence there. Just north of Kabul, in the town of Bagram, it was once the largest U.S. military base in Afghanistan. Today, after almost 20 years, the last remaining American troops left Bagram. The World's Shirin Jafari has been covering this news closely. What do we know about this withdrawal, Shirin?
Marco, we know that American troops left in the early hours of morning Afghanistan time. U.S. Army infantrymen closed the airfield, and there was no report of any sort of ceremony or any lowering of the flag or anything like that that typically comes with events like these. The troops basically packed up and left quietly in the dark. And just to give you a bit of background about the base, Marco, Bagram has been the main center of operation for the U.S. military in Afghanistan for the past 20 years. It's a huge base, and it was built in the 1950s by the Soviets. They used it when they were in Afghanistan for about 10 years between 1979 and 1989. And then in 2001, the US and NATO forces took over the base, and it grew. At one point, there were about 10,000 troops stationed at the base, and there are two runways for aircrafts, hospitals, restaurants, dental clinics, gyms, you name it. I should also point out that there is a prison at Bagram, which has been described as Afghanistan's Guantanamo. The U.S. held prisoners there up until 2014, when it handed over the facility to the Afghans. And over the years, there have been numerous allegations of torture and abuse at this detention center.
Over the years, Shirin, tens of thousands of U.S. troops have passed through Bagram, as you said, during deployments to Afghanistan. The veterans who were deployed there, what are they telling you today?
Today, I spoke with David D. Carrion. He was a Marine Corps pilot in Afghanistan in 2012 and 2013. This is what he remembers of Bagram.
It was a little bit of military and a lot of comfort.
David said he met a lot of people from different countries, service members who were serving at the base in Afghanistan. They were members of their coalition partners. And I asked him what was his favorite thing to do there.
Turkish coffee.
He just wanted the coffee.
He really loved getting Turkish coffee at the base. And then I asked him how he's feeling today when he heard the news that American forces have left Bagram.
Very disappointed. I think we need to stick with it. I think we need to honor the sacrifices that many of us have made going there, and especially those that shed blood there.
David says the U.S. is leaving Afghanistan at a vulnerable time. The Taliban has been making advances, he says. There is no political settlement yet. And so that leaves the door open for chaos.
Right. I mean, it's something we've reported on the show. It's a concern many experts have. How is the Taliban responding to the U.S. leaving the Bagram airbase?
I messaged the Taliban spokesman Zabihullah Mujahid, and he said the group has no immediate plan to take over Bagram Air Base, but that Afghans will make decisions about that later. That's what he said. I also heard from another Taliban spokesman, Sohail Shaheen. This is what he said in a voice message.
We welcome the American forces leaving the main airbase of Bagram. We hope all the foreign soldier, American soldier, pull out from our country soon.
Marco, this, as you know, has been a request of Taliban for a very long time. They have been asking for foreign troops to leave Afghanistan. And now they have their wish. The issue, though, is that they have not engaged in peace talks with the current Afghan government. So it's really unclear what will happen next.
So troops have left the Bagram Air Base. Are there any U.S. troops left in Afghanistan now, Shireen?
It's important to point out that even though a lot of American and coalition forces have left Afghanistan, there are going to be some troops left. For example, the U.S. has said that it will keep about 650 troops in country to protect its embassy in Kabul. There are also ongoing discussions between the U.S. and various other countries, including Turkey, to keep some military personnel at the Kabul airport to make sure that it remains open and it remains operational.
The world's Shireen Jafari speaking with us about the U.S. departure from the Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan. Shireen, thank you for your reporting.
You're welcome, Marco.
So far this year, thousands of migrant children have arrived alone at the U.S.-Mexico border. But the number of children in U.S. custody has dropped from a high of 22,000 this spring to about 14,000 now. More children are being placed in homes outside of government custody. That's led to some emergency shelters shutting down. As the world's immigration editor Monica Campbell reports, many are welcoming the shift and say further change is overdue.
Earlier this year, the government quickly set up about a dozen emergency shelters to take in unaccompanied migrant children. The biggest shelter is at Fort Bliss, an army base in El Paso, Texas. At one point, more than 4,400 children were there in giant white tents, ages 13 to 17, crammed in rows of cots. Javier Becerra is the Secretary of Health and Human Services, which oversees the care of migrant children. He spoke with reporters this week.
While they're in our care, we understand that we have a job to do and a legal obligation to make sure they are safe and healthy.
Recent reports say that care isn't adequate, especially at shelters like Fort Bliss. Kids, mostly from Central America, told child welfare advocates they're served spoiled food, trash is piling up, and that the lights are kept on 24/7. There's also little access to mental health services. Fewer kids are in custody, though. They're being reunited faster with their relatives in the U.S., and those still in custody are being moved to licensed shelters. U.S. officials are now closing several of the emergency shelters.
And so we are trying to see which facilities, the emergency intake sites, we can continue to demobilize and still provide the care that we will need.
The government will keep Fort Bliss open, though. It can house up to 10,000 kids. Beds the government wants on hand. But critics worry that relying on mega shelters like Fort Bliss risk bringing back those dangerous conditions for children.
Let's work together to really revamp the system from start to finish so that we don't have to go back to this kind of, you know, triaging ad hoc moment that we found ourselves since near the start of this year.
Wendy Young leads Kids in Needs of Defense, a nonprofit in D.C. She was also concerned when the government sought volunteers from agencies like the Social Security Administration and NASA to work at the shelters for a stint. People not trained to work with kids, especially kids who don't speak English or are dealing with trauma.
We are calling for the deployment of child welfare experts at the border from the moment that children arrived to get that processing started from day one.
Other advocates would like the Biden administration to take a wider look at the question of unaccompanied minors. Gladys Molina runs the Young Center for Immigrant Children's Rights in Phoenix.
A comprehensive look and how they can stay out of government care, allow kids with an adult caregiver to present at the border and release them as soon as possible after being processed by Border Patrol.
Because many migrant children don't head to the U.S. border alone. They travel with an adult, a grandmother, an older cousin. they become unaccompanied once separated by U.S. officials from that relative at the border, since that adult isn't a parent or guardian. Melina doesn't think this should happen, but not everyone agrees the U.S. should keep the door open to unaccompanied children at all. Pete Hermanson is a longtime, now retired, Border Patrol agent. He lives near Knoxville, Tennessee. Border Patrol agents often encounter unaccompanied children first.
I think that we've put the Border Patrol and we've put our immigration services in a position where they're stressed, where they're not resourced properly, and we're not handling the situation properly.
He believes the U.S. should work more with Mexico to return migrant children back to their home countries. But for now, the U.S. is working to keep places like Fort Bliss in Texas as an option and allow children arriving alone to the U.S. to stay. For The World, I'm Monica Campbell.
A popular activist who fought corruption in Ghana was killed this week. Ibrahim Mohamed, better known as Kaka, used social media to help launch a hashtag, Fix the Country Now. A mob attacked him on Monday. Young activists who protested his death were then shot at by police. Two more people were killed. Here to talk with us about this social movement and the events this week in Ghana is journalist Ridwan Karim Dini Osman. He joins us from the capital, Accra. Tell us, first of all, Ridwan, who was Kaka, the man who was killed, and what his movement was all about?
Well, Fix the Country Now activist Kaka Mohamed, popularly known as Kaka, like you've already mentioned, was attacked by a mob while returning home on Sunday at Ejira, a farming community in the Ashanti region of southern Ghana. Now, unconfirmed reports say the 45-year-old was killed because of his rants on social media, which were believed to have made the government unpopular. Now, Kake's family revealed that the deceased had received threats over his Facebook tirade before the deadly attack.
And it's a little confusing, this mob that showed up at his house. I've read that the police may have been involved, or perhaps these were citizens sent by the police. Have there been any arrests made in his death? And is there any further information on who this mob was?
We have very little information. I think the police hasn't given enough public information about, in terms of the profiling they have done on these suspects. But we know that they have arrested three suspects. And as I speak to you now, they are in court. We are monitoring closely what the outcome of today's proceeding will be. But we know that they are being charged in connection with the murder incident.
So regardless of who made up this mob that attacked Kaka and ultimately led to his death, Kaka's neighborhood, I gather, went out to protest afterwards. And now the news of his death has reverberated all over Ghana. What kind of support does Kaka and his movement actually have across the country?
Now, during his burial on Tuesday in Ejira, things got bloody when a joint police and military team confronted irate youth who had taken to the street to demand justice. Now, the joint security force shot and killed two suspects and left about four others critically injured. Kofi Nsia is one of the protesters. I spoke to him earlier.
I had to rush to the scene. I went there and full of blood. So I had to follow up to the hospital, and lo and behold, two dead, about six or eight or nine people also injured.
Ridwan, I'm kind of confused because Ghana has enjoyed a really positive reputation in recent years. For such a model nation, should we be surprised that there is a movement called Fix the Country Now in Ghana? I mean, what started that?
Well, in the lead up to the 2020 elections in Ghana, the president gave some reliefs, particularly on water and electricity because of the general economic hardship emanating from the COVID-19 pandemic. However, early 2021, so many taxes were reimposed, including on water and electricity. Now, this led to anger as many Ghanaians continued to struggle financially. Many resorted to social media to express their frustration, and that gave birth to the Fix the Country Now movement and what happened in Ejira.
So what happens now in this kind of fraught week to the Fix the Country Now movement? Where does it go from here?
The movement had been barred by the police from protesting because of COVID earlier. Now, this was challenged in court, and the movement won the right to demonstrate, but they were told they must work with the police. So far, however, the Fix the Country Now has yet to declare whether it will carry out further demonstrations. Time possibly will tell.
Reporter Ridwan Karim, Dini Osman in Accra, the Ghanaian capital. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
We'll be right back. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. It's the world. It has been a tough week for Canada. Heat and wildfires, nearly 200 more unmarked graves of Indigenous children discovered at a former residential school, and this ongoing issue, Canada's Indigenous communities want birth alerts to stop. That's when a newborn can be taken from a parent without consent. The practice is meant to protect babies, but advocates argue it disproportionately affects Indigenous communities. As the world's Bianca Hillier reports, most Canadian provinces are listening.
Newfoundland and Labrador is the most recent example.
It was colonial, it was racist, and we recognize that.
John Abbott, Minister of Children, Seniors, and Social Development, said this week the province will no longer issue birth alerts.
I think federal government and other provincial governments recognize that child protection policy has to change in this country.
The announcement is welcome news to Krista Mogridge. She's a former child services social worker in the province.
There's still a lot of inequality in services for Indigenous people in Canada.
Mogridge currently works for the Nunatsiavut government's Department of Health and Social Development. She says birth alerts have contributed to a deep sense of fear within Indigenous communities. Expectant parents often worry, she says, that asking for help during pregnancy will be judged as being an unfit parent, which could lead to their child being taken away.
The fear could actually impact a mom's or an expectant parent's decision to reach out for support or prenatal care, and actually impact their decision to go through with the pregnancy or not.
The government data to confirm these fears varies greatly by province. In Saskatchewan, from 2015 to 2019, a reported 78% of newborns who came into government care were Indigenous. In British Columbia in 2018, Indigenous parents made up 58% of people subjected to birth alerts. In Newfoundland and Labrador, though, the numbers are unclear. But before the practice ended this week, community members there say they have seen a sharp decline in alerts in the past 2 years.
It's a step in the right direction.
Jermaine Benouin is the executive director of the Innu Roundtable Secretariat, an organization that works to provide support services before child welfare gets involved. Despite the decline, Benouin says fear of the practice has lingered. Just a couple of weeks ago, she got a late-night call from someone at the hospital.
There was a lady there that was giving birth and asked me, can somebody be here with me? I'm afraid that the child welfare will be coming in. And I said, they probably won't, but if they do, give me a call. I can be there in 10 minutes.
Because of this, Benouin is glad to see birth alerts formally end in Newfoundland and Labrador. The province is one of the last in Canada to discontinue the practice. After a 2019 report from the National Inquiry into Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls called it racist and discriminatory. But the policy remains on the books in New Brunswick and Nova Scotia, where advocates are hoping to use this week's momentum to end the alerts.
Here in Nova Scotia, we're not fulfilling that obligation that we have towards reconciliation.
Martha Painter, a nurse and advocate for ending the policy in Nova Scotia, spoke to the CBC this week.
It certainly demonstrates that the province is not prioritizing the needs of these very marginalized families.
A representative from Nova Scotia's government told me they're currently working toward ending the use of birth alerts, and the New Brunswick government said they're also reviewing the practice. Back in Newfoundland and Labrador, the conversation is now focused on replacing the alerts to make sure families get the support they need. Here's Jermaine Benouin again.
We're not saying that we don't need child protection. We're saying there's a better way to do it. And the Innu people should be the ones that design this system that would work for our people.
That is the plan going forward. Minister John Abbott says they're still working with Indigenous leaders to finalize specifics, but the Innu Nation and Nunatsiavut government will soon have more control of their child welfare services. For the world, I'm Bianca Hillier.
In the U.S., thousands of immigrants live in limbo. They're here legally, but only with temporary work permits. For decades, they've lobbied Washington to create a pathway to citizenship. In 2019, one group succeeded. Liberians living in the U.S., many for as long as 3 decades, could finally apply for green cards. But as the world's Daisy Contreras reports, the path hasn't been easy.
Yata Kiazolu remembers the long list of documents her immigration lawyer requested last year.
So I printed bank records, school transcripts, pay stubs.
That was for her green card application. Kiazolu is 30 years old and lives in Los Angeles. She arrived to the U.S. when she was 6. Her family is from Liberia.
So we ended up staying with our family. We had extended family that had already left Liberia.
Many fled 2 civil wars in the 90s and an Ebola outbreak in 2014. Those who made it to the U.S. lived with temporary protection from deportation and a work permit, renewable every year, if the president allowed it. For 30 years, Liberians in the U.S. have fought for a permanent solution. That came in 2019, when Congress passed the law giving them a pathway to citizenship. A small group of Liberians, about 10,000, would qualify. So it was a relatively tiny program included in a large defense spending bill that also gave more cash to Border Patrol. When Kiazolu heard about the news, for her, it was a big deal.
I was still very much, first of all, in a state of just shock, right, that this had happened and happened so quickly. But I think I continued to just be in a state of cautious optimism that nothing would feel real to me until I got my green card.
She was cautious because the deadline to apply was closing in.
It's difficult. It's a difficult process to go through, especially on your own. And in a pandemic, with the way the program is being administered, it makes it just difficult.
Out of the 10,000 Liberians who might qualify, only about a third have submitted their application. That worries Brianne Palmer. She's with Undocu Black Network, which advocates for Black undocumented immigrants in the U.S. But she understands why some Liberians in the U.S. may be wary.
They don't trust that this incredible program that was passed through Congress under the Trump administration is real. It feels a little bit too good to be true to some people.
Palmer also says some requirements are hard to meet. One, for example, asks for an unexpired Liberian passport. Many don't have one. And during a pandemic, renewing is not easy. She says these requirements and a looming deadline can discourage potential applicants. USCIS, the agency that processes applications, said in an email that they've been working on expanding their outreach. Still, immigration lawyers like Lenore Miliborghetti say people who are on the fence should at least get advice. Miliborghetti is with the Immigrant Law Center of Minnesota. That state has the largest Liberian population in the U.S.
We can really evaluate the situation and let people know if they have reason to be concerned or if it's okay to go forward, because it is a wonderful opportunity.
She says the difficult process is what's expected for a green card application. It's rigorous, she says, but possible. As for Yata Kiazolu, she can now breathe easier. She received her green card earlier this year. And as soon as that happened, she quickly applied for citizenship. Last week, she became a U.S. citizen.
In the thick of it, I didn't think it would happen. I didn't know what would happen, but it felt like this is worth fighting for.
She also says the Liberian program shows it's not impossible to pass a much bigger immigration reform bill, but it also shows that the process could end up leaving some people out. For The World, I'm Daisy Contreras.
You're with The World. Hungary is set to ban gay characters on TV shows airing before 10 p.m. That's led to a fierce backlash across the European Union.
To accept yourself being gay was my most difficult thing. And to hear now that it is because maybe I watched something on TV when I was younger is unacceptable.
Also ahead, if a Picasso is hidden in the woods, does it make a sound? Coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World, a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. The small town of Lytton, British Columbia, population 250, has the slogan Canada's Hotspot because it's known for reaching high temperatures. But this week's high of 121 degrees Fahrenheit is only part of the reason that Lytton is on our minds. On Wednesday, in the midst of those hot and dry conditions, a fire broke out that burned 90% of the town to the ground. Matt Pascoe has been organizing some of the relief efforts. He's chair of the Nflakapam Nation Tribal Council that includes Lytton. Matt, first of all, our condolences to the terrible losses your community has been dealt this week.
Thank you for those kind words. It's been certainly a trying few days.
You're around 40 minutes drive north of Lytton right now. Can you talk a bit about what the weather and fire conditions have been like?
We're under emergency watch and could be evacuated at any time. It's a lot of smoke, very thick. Temperatures have actually dropped, you know, on the ground, but it's still hot and still very, very dangerous.
I know a vast majority of the displaced people this week are members of the Nflakopam Nation. What has your role been in helping get people to safety?
As the chair of the Tribal Council, of which Lytton First Nation is a member of, we tasked as many of them that could help turn their efforts towards coordinating and ensuring the safety of those that were evacuated. When the evacuation happened, and it happened very quickly, the task of our tribal council and the staff was to create a mustering point, because the province of British Columbia was not prepared for this. So we stepped in. At the time, we had no idea how many would be coming, so we bought every hotel room in Kamloops that we could find, and we filled them up.
Can you share a story with us about anybody who had to flee the fire, how fast they had to go, and maybe what they lost in the destruction?
One of our staff members at the Tribal Council was fleeing the town and had to drive by watching his home completely erupted in flames, knowing that everything, all his belongings, everything is gone. There are people that have nothing but the clothes on their back and not even sure where their families are.
I mean, a town like Lytton really does seem to be the human face of climate change, the history of First Nations people. Mm-hmm. That's kind of in the foreground. And in the background, or maybe I should say also in the foreground, is climate change. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and President Joe Biden have both pointed to human-caused climate change as a major driver of this deadly heat. I'm wondering if you have faith that leaders can tackle the historic injustices against Indigenous people and deal with climate change at the same time.
I am confident in our leadership in pushing this agenda forward. I am not confident that these other governance structures have taken it seriously to this point. The world is changing. We have no choice but to change and adapt to it. Would they do it without these crises? No, I don't believe they would. They should have been listening to our previous leaders who have been saying this for generations. We see it in the wildlife. We see it in the salmon fishery. We see it in so many places. It's so obvious. But it's not a crisis enough for them. You know, this is not the first community to burn to the ground in the last couple of years, and I don't believe it'll be the last. The narrative needs to change. The policies need to change. They need to be respectful of Indigenous jurisdiction. I think that with that comes good things, including positive things for this environment.
Matt, 90% of Lytton, as I said, was destroyed by fire. I mean, it's really hard to fathom. Are residents hoping to move back? I mean, is there even a road to recovery for Lytton?
Yes. The community of Lytton and Tlakatmuk members there, that is their home, and they will be back. It will become thriving again. There's no question in our mind.
Matt Pascoe is chair of the Nflakopam Nation Tribal Council, which includes Lytton, British Columbia, the town of 250 people burned down this week amid the scorching hot temperatures in that region. Matt, again, our deepest condolences to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Hundreds of people are thought to have died from that extreme heat in British Columbia in the past week. Historically, since the beginning of the Industrial Age, average temperatures in British Columbia have risen about 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit. But when temperatures shoot up well beyond that, like this week, the question emerges, what role does climate change play in these bursts of extreme weather? The World's Carolyn Beeler spoke with a group of scientists who knew that question was coming.
Climate scientist Hiertian van Oldenburg was watching temperature records shatter in the Pacific Northwest and Western Canada, and on Monday he decided it was time to mobilize.
Seeing how far this is out of the normal range, we thought that it would have a huge impact and it would be worth our while to investigate it.
Van Oldenburg is a climate researcher at the Dutch Meteorological Institute and the co-leader of a kind of scientific rapid response team called World Weather Attribution.
We try to make clear the links between extreme weather and climate change on a relatively quick timescale.
He sent out the bat signal to the group on Monday. There was an email recruiting scientists and a Zoom meeting divvying up the work. Soon, around 24 scientists in 7 countries were compiling data in the same Google Doc and running models to answer this question.
Whether climate change has influenced this event and by how much?
Sarah Kuh is also at the Dutch Meteorological Institute and is co-leading this study, which aims to have an early answer to that question by next Wednesday. That is warp speed in science, and a main reason this research collaborative launched in 2014.
There's a massive interest at the time of the event, and that's when, yeah, the press, people like yourselves are interested, but also decision and policy makers are interested. And, yeah, if we don't give an answer that's based on scientific methods, then some kind of answer is going to be obtained, and that answer will probably not be as robust as the one that we will produce.
In recent years, this group has found that the record rains during Hurricane Harvey were 15% more intense due to climate change, that last year's Siberian heat wave would have been nearly impossible without global warming, and that a frost damaging vineyards in France this spring was 20 to 120% more likely due to climate change. Findings like these aren't published in a journal or peer-reviewed by outside scientists, which is usually the standard for academic science, but that allows them to get the results out fast. Here's how they do it. First, they collect current and historical weather data and define exactly what they're studying.
Once we define an event, then we try to calculate the probability of the event in the current climate.
This is Francis Zwiers, director of the Pacific Climate Impacts Consortium at the University of Victoria. He's been helping out with statistics questions while hiding from the sun and blasting his fans at home this week.
And we try to recalculate the probability of what the event might have been in a cooler climate or a climate of 100 years ago.
The scientists use climate models to give them more data to look at and the ability to pinpoint the specific impacts of greenhouse gases. Those models, Hiertian van Oldenburg says, are just like weather models.
So they are like the 10-day weather forecast. And they just start at a certain moment and you just run them forward and you have all your depressions and your high pressure system and your heat waves and your cold waves and the normal weather, but then in a computer, not in the real world.
They let these models run, keeping most things constant.
Every year you increase the CO2 concentration a little bit. And then you have kind of an artificial world that should look like the real one.
The extra years of data in these virtual worlds and the ability to zero in on the impacts of greenhouse gases on extreme events help answer the question, how likely would this event have been with and without climate change? When I spoke to Sarah Kuh yesterday afternoon, she glanced at the group's Google Doc to see how many of those artificial worlds had been analyzed.
The model results are still coming in. At the moment, we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9.
By this morning, results from 20 models had arrived. This week, the high temperature in Canada broke the old national record by an astounding 8 degrees Fahrenheit. That is so far out of the ordinary that a combination of extreme weather patterns and climate change are likely at play, including possible feedback loops that Kuh warns their study won't examine.
However, we can be really confident that climate change is having an impact in raising the background temperatures of heat waves in general. So we can produce a very robust statement on that.
Beyond that, we'll just have to wait till Wednesday to hear more. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
The Paris-based Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development has announced that 130 countries have agreed on a global minimum tax. The move is an effort to keep multinational companies from dodging taxes. Read more about it in our newsletter. Sign up at theworld.org/newsletters. Leaders in the European Union are calling for Hungary to leave the bloc. Those calls came at a recent EU summit. They want Hungary out because of a new law there that bans content portraying homosexuality from being shown to kids on TV or in school sex ed programs. But does this really mean that Hungary's days in the European Union are numbered? The world's Orla Barry reports.
Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban is used to rubbing his fellow EU leaders the wrong way. But this time feels different. At a recent meeting, his counterparts across the EU spoke of their disgust at his new law. Dutch Premier Mark Rutte was the most blunt.
Als je Victor niet bevalt...
If you don't like it, Rutte told Orban, there is an alternative. Get out of the Union. The summit was supposed to be all about the pandemic and the bloc's relationship with Russia. Instead, members of the European Parliament were in tears, listening to the Prime Minister of Luxembourg reflect on his struggles to be accepted as a gay man. Xavier Bertel had harsh words for Orban.
If he really thinks that by watching a film or to speak in a classroom about sexual orientation makes that you get gay, he really doesn't understand anything.
He was speaking to reporters outside Parliament.
To accept yourself being gay was my most difficult thing. And to hear now that it is because maybe I watched something on TV when I was younger is unacceptable.
Ursula von der Leyen, the EU Commission President, vowed to protect people from the new ruling.
We have written to the Hungarian authorities, the Hungarian government, detailing out our legal concerns. We will protect all citizens wherever they live in our union and whomever they love.
Viktor Orban wasn't a bit happy with the showdown. He complained that he was being attacked from all sides. The problem is that people misunderstand the new law, Orban told journalists. In fact, he said he's a supporter of LGBTQ rights.
I'm a fighter for the rights. You know, I'm a freedom fighter in the communist regime. Homosexuality was punished. And I fought for their freedom and their rights. So I am defending the rights of the homosexual guys. But this law is not about that. It's about the right of the kids and the parents.
Orban says the ruling will allow parents to choose how they want to educate their children about sex. Critics argue that the law effectively equates being gay with paedophilia. It also bans TV shows and films with gay characters or themes from being shown to those under 18, meaning comedies like Friends or even the Harry Potter movies could be banned from TV before 10 p.m. Zsolt Szekeres is a lawyer with the Hungarian Helsinki Committee, a human rights NGO. He says the ruling has had a chilling effect.
Many people are just fundamentally afraid and upset, and many are considering leaving Hungary altogether.
Szekeres says homophobic attacks in Hungary have increased since the law was passed in Parliament last month.
There were two German girls coming to a match in Hungary. Hungary is one of the host countries of the European Championship, who wore rainbow painting on their face and they were spat on by some Hungarian fans. Just a couple of days ago, two gay doctors were beaten up in the southern city of Pécs.
He believes that Orban is less concerned with his claim about protecting children and more interested in safeguarding his political future. Hungary has parliamentary elections next year, and for the first time in a decade, the governing Fidesz party faces a real challenge from a united opposition. Daniel Hegedus with the German Marshall Fund thinks there could be another factor at play too.
And turn away the attention of the scandal of the Fudan University.
Orban's government has plans to open a campus of China's Fudan University in Budapest. But the news sparked a massive backlash over cost and fears of increasing influence of China's communist authorities. Hegedus says the new ruling was a diversionary tactic. But why has this Hungarian law sparked so much anger in Brussels? After all, Orban's stance on migration and on press freedom have also clashed with EU standards.
I think Prime Minister Orban violated a very serious taboo of European politics. The taboo that homosexuality can be brought in any sort of relationship with pedophilia, because that stage of the European politics was left behind approximately 60, 70 years ago in Western Europe.
The EU Commission has taken a step towards legal action against Hungary. Germany's interior minister says they should withhold EU funds from the country, but not everyone is on board. Both Poland and Slovenia appear to have Orban's back. As for kicking Hungary out of the bloc, Daniel Hegedus says,
no, there are no legal ways to kick out a member state from the European Union, even if that member state, like Hungary for many years, is obviously not complying with the fundamental obligations of EU member states.
And the possibility that Orbán will leave the Union voluntarily is also pretty unlikely. Hungary needs EU money, and most Hungarians like being part of the Union. EU leaders are talking about action, but with the summer break looming and pandemic problems facing them back home, Orbán may once again walk away with little more than a bruised ego. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
It was an art heist that eluded Greek authorities for nearly a decade. In 2012, several works of art, including one by Pablo Picasso, were brazenly stolen from Greece's National Gallery. The thieves left behind only the frames. Nearly a decade later, it appears that Greek authorities have finally cracked the case. Earlier this week, they arrested a 49-year-old construction worker and self-proclaimed art lover who confessed to stealing the paintings. According to reports, the man told police he acted alone and pulled off the job by tricking the museum's one guard at the time to shut off the alarm system. For years, the man had the art hanging in his home. But after reading in local media that police were close to solving the case, he hid the stolen art in a wooded ravine. In a video, police walk through the area just outside of Athens. There's one painting, an officer says as the camera zooms in. It's wrapped up and stashed under branches. Police have not released many details on exactly what led them to the suspect now. Greek Minister of Culture Lina Menthoni did say the recovered Picasso painting was particularly important and valuable for Greece. The artwork is titled Head of a Woman. On the back of the painting, there's an inscription from the artist himself that reads, "For the Greek people, a tribute from Picasso." The artist gifted the painting to the country's National Gallery after World War II to thank Greece for resisting the Nazis. Greek authorities have also recovered another oil painting, this one by Dutch artist Piet Mondrian, stolen that same night in 2012. They say visitors to the National Gallery will soon be able, once again, to see the works on display. Our next story is about two households, both alike in dignity, as Shakespeare might say. It's a story of two families woven into the history of 19th and 20th century Shanghai. Both Jewish, both extremely successful business tycoons who opened opulent hotels and lived a life of luxury in Shanghai before the Communist Revolution. And that is where their paths diverged, but we'll get to that in a second. This is a story of two families, the Sassoons and the Kadouris, and how their legacies shaped the city, even today. It's the subject of Jonathan Kaufman's latest book, The Last Kings of Shanghai, The Rival Jewish Dynasties That Helped Create Modern China. Kaufman's also director of the Journalism School at Northeastern University. These two families, in a way, track the story of modern China. Jonathan, I'd love if you could start here by painting a picture for us. We're in Shanghai at one of those hotels I just mentioned in the 1930s. What is life like for the Sassoons and the Kadouris?
It's pretty glamorous. The Communist Party, of course, has been founded in Shanghai in 1921. But about a mile away from where the communists are gathering, there's incredible opulence along the Bund, that Art Deco stretch of buildings in Shanghai. Shanghai has become one of the most glamorous cities on earth. Charlie Chaplin goes there to visit. Wallace Simpson, who will end up making the King of England leave his throne, is photographed just nude, only wearing a simple bathing costume. The Kadouris and the Sassoons really made Shanghai a place that everyone had to visit. And they also presided over a tremendous amount of inequality. There were people literally dying in the streets in front of their hotels and in front of their businesses.
So where did this fabulous wealth for both these families come from? Because the source of some of it is controversial, right?
Absolutely. The Sassoons made their money in opium. When the communists took over finally in 1949, they seized the Sassoon business records. And they concluded that the Sassoons made about $1 billion in the opium trade, which they then turned into real estate holdings, factories, and so forth. The Kadouris were a little different. They made their money in factories and real estate, but they also invested heavily in Hong Kong, which positioned them to be making fortunes in two Chinese cities.
These families are also rivals, but they also work together at a key moment. Tell us about their role helping Jewish refugees during the Second World War.
Well, starting in the late 1930s, the ships that were taking Charlie Chaplin and others to Shanghai start bringing different passengers. And these are Jews who are fleeing the Nazis. Just about every place in the world closed their gates, including the United States, Britain, all around the world. But Shanghai, because it was occupied in part by the British, in part by Americans, in part by the Japanese, really didn't have a functioning government. And what that meant was that if a Jewish refugee could make it to Shanghai, they would be safe. What the Sassoons of the Kadouris did was they set up a school to educate Jewish children. They gave these refugees jobs. But most importantly, Victor Sassoon negotiated with the Japanese to keep the gates open in Shanghai so that all these refugees could find safety. And ultimately, on the eve of Pearl Harbor, when the gates were finally closed, 18,000 Jews had made it to safety in Shanghai, and they survived the war there.
That's a fascinating part of the story. So let's move to the point where the Sassoons and the Kadouris paths diverge, the communist revolution in 1949. Contrast for us the different paths these two families took and what the young Chinese communists made of these foreign capitalists that were moving and shaking China.
Well, the Sassoons were brilliant business people, but it turned out they were not good politicians. They never really saw the rise of communism, even though Victor Sassoon, who was the billionaire playboy presiding over Shanghai in the 1930s, he was actually having an affair with an American journalist who was also having an affair with a left-wing Chinese communist. And she would warn Victor Sassoon, saying, you know, you have to take these communists seriously, but Victor Sassoon didn't believe it. And so after World War II, he returned to China thinking the parties would resume, the money would keep flowing in. But of course, that didn't happen. The Chinese, within a few years, surrounded Shanghai. They invaded. Victor Sassoon had to flee, and the Chinese seized all of his holdings, and he basically lost almost everything. The Kadouris were smarter. They had begun moving their money out of Shanghai to Hong Kong. And after World War II, when the communists conquered Shanghai, they basically started rebuilding in Hong Kong and were very influential in turning Hong Kong in a way into the new Shanghai, a British colony that was incredibly wealthy. And today, the Kadouris are the richest Western family in China. They're worth more than $13 billion.
We're talking a lot of history this week, Jonathan, with the 100th anniversary of the Chinese Communist Party. So how is the history of these families, the Kadouris and the Sassoons, remembered in China? And how do you see it?
It's actually quite interesting. You know, if you visit any school in China, there's a poster on the wall that says, never forget national humiliation. This belief that for 100 years, China was oppressed by the West and others until the Communist Party came along, liberated China, and has set it on this path of growth and being a world power. But the truth is much more complicated. You know, in the 1920s and 1930s, China was incredibly cosmopolitan. It was open to the world. And China boomed because of that. Many Chinese businesses really learned about the West and learned to succeed from these Western families, from the Kadouris, the Sassoons, and others. And when we look at Hong Kong, too, the growth of Hong Kong was really based on it being a cosmopolitan city. I think right now China's going through a very nationalist phase. It's something we can understand here in America, that there are times when everyone becomes very nationalistic and doesn't want to be tied into the global economy. So I think short term, this is a history that the Chinese are very wary of. But I do think that, you know, anyone in China, the intellectuals, certainly businessmen in China, business executives, recognize the importance of China being part of the world and the sort of impact that these families had in the 1920s, in the 1930s, and that still resonate today.
Today, though, Shanghai, wealthy, globalist, cosmopolitan, it'd feel very familiar to the Kadouris and the Sassoons, right?
Right, but I think the major change is that the power has shifted. In the 1920s and 1930s, the Sassoons and the Kadouris were the kings of Shanghai. They dominated the government, they dominated the economy, they dominated politics. But these days, the communists are now in charge, the Chinese are now in charge. The days of imperialism and colonialism have passed. So I think the question is there a middle ground between the kind of imperialism and colonialism that led to so much inequality and unhappiness and death and suffering for the Chinese, and a system where the Chinese are so repressive that the West doesn't want to have anything to do with them and they want nothing to do with the world? I think think trying to find a middle ground where capitalism and communism can meet is something that the Communist Party will be trying to figure out and Western companies are trying to figure out as well.
Jonathan Kaufman is the author of The Last Kings of Shanghai, the rival Jewish dynasties that helped create modern China. Jonathan, thanks for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Have a safe and relaxing July 4th weekend, everyone. We'll be back with you on Monday. From PRX.